Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Melissa Block, and this is On Point. 6 decades of Castro rule in Cuba have come to an end today, with 86-year-old Raul Castro stepping down as president. His brother Fidel led the country before him for almost 50 years. Now a new generation takes over, at a time when U.S. policy toward Cuba has hardened under President Trump. So now what? This hour on Point, the end of an era in Cuba, and what's ahead for U.S.-Cuban relations. You can join us on air or online. Can you imagine a Cuba without the Castros? Cuban Americans, what do you make of this moment? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first from Miami is Alan Gomez, correspondent with USA Today. He has been traveling many times to Cuba over the last 15 years. Alan Gomez, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And let's talk about the new president of Cuba, Miguel Díaz-Canel, 57 years old. He spoke today in Cuba. What did he say?
Well, the speech was very much, it sounded like something that could have come from either of the Castros. I mean, he spent a lot of time talking about the glories of the revolution, the education system, the health system. He talked about fighting back the imperialist subversion attempts in the country. And he talked about continuing that socialist model that was implemented by Fidel and Raul, saying, quote, the revolution continues. So in many ways, he was trying to deliver a message that this is, even though he's young, he's new, he's a fresh face, he's very much going to carry forth with the ideals set forth by his predecessors.
Interesting. He's saying the revolution continues. He was born after the revolution. He's 57. And it's striking when you look at images. If we think about Cuban leadership, we're used to seeing the Castro brothers in uniform, right? In olive drab, Raul with full stars and bars. Miguel Díaz-Canel looks like a businessman to me. He looks like a technocrat.
Yeah, I mean, you can't travel very far in Cuba without seeing some black and white image of the Castro brothers fighting with Che Guevara in the mountains, and that sort of was their basis of their legitimacy in the eyes of the Cubans for so long. And so here we have Díaz-Canel, who was born after the revolution, who at 57 qualifies as young by Cuban leadership standards. He's been, he's kind of steadily risen through the ranks of the Communist Party. He was the education minister for a time. He's praised for his adoption of technology, which Cuban media talks about him using an iPad, which is obviously pretty rare down in Cuba, and being one of the first high-ranking government officials to regularly bring a laptop into government meetings. But at the same time, we've heard him talk about the need to silence independent media and possibly shut them down. So it's a double-edged sword there. And that shows a little bit of the two sides of things, where he's trying to appeal to a younger generation by being more technological, being more open to internet access, but also being very hardline when it comes to preserving and protecting the revolution and doing anything necessary to do so.
And let's, in that vein, let's listen to some tape from then Vice President Miguel Díaz Canel, now president, speaking with reporters yesterday, talking about his plans to defend the Cuban revolution, especially now at this time of tense relations with the United States.
We are encouraging, reaffirming, and consolidating continuity, which is very important for the defense of the revolution, which today is being threatened and attacked by a relationship with the U.S. that has deteriorated.
And that relationship is key right now, isn't it? Because of what we've seen with the Trump administration rolling back moves under the Obama administration to normalize relations. That is now a very different stance from the United States.
Incredibly different. I mean, just a couple of years ago, President Obama was sitting with Raul Castro at a baseball game in Havana.
Yeah.
And here we are now, where President Trump has pulled out the majority of diplomats working at the recently reopened U.S. embassy in Havana, ordered diplomats out of the Cuban embassy in Washington, D.C., and making it harder for Americans to travel to or do business with Cuba. And all of this stemming, by the way, from these still unexplained, quote-unquote, health attacks that are some of our diplomats and some Canadian diplomats have complained about during their time in Havana. So yeah, just a couple of years ago, this transition would have been very different. It would have been viewed in a very different way as just the next step in this improving, normalizing relationship. But what we have now is Díaz-Canel talking, very explicitly about the need to maintain the line and warning of the imperialist threat on the country. And so it's and the U.S. just doesn't have the presence there that it did just a couple of years ago to either, soften that blow or improve those relations.
And we should say, Alan Gomez, that Raul Castro, while stepping down as president, still maintains an extremely important position within the Cuban leadership.
Yeah, I have a feeling if you talk to any Cuban Americans on the show later on,
which we're about to do, yes.
Yeah, I think they'll make that point very clearly. But it is important. This is not the first non-Castro president. Technically, over the last 60 years, there have been a couple others back when Fidel was firmly in power. This is a different situation, though, where Díaz-Canel is the president, and Castro will still be there. I mean, he's getting old. A lot of people think that he does really want to ease up and move to the eastern portion of the island where he was from, where Fidel Castro's remains are interred, and kind of, ease back after 60 years of obviously a busy life. But he will still be the head of the Communist Party. His family and relatives are littered throughout the regime, and the people who owe their positions throughout Cuba, throughout the government, mm-hmm. throughout the economy, to Raul and to Fidel are still there. So he's still the one that they have to answer to. The question now going forward is how much power Díaz-Canel will have to act on his own and whether he's literally going to have to double check everything with Raul before he does anything.
Great point. Alan Gomez with USA Today joining us from Miami. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And joining us now are two Cuban Americans who each left Cuba when they were 11 years old. Pedro Freire joins us from Miami. He's a lawyer with the firm Ackerman and specializes in helping U.S. companies do business in Cuba. Pedro Freire, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
And joining me from New Haven, Connecticut, is Carlos Ayer, Professor of History and Religious Studies at Yale University. Professor Ayer, welcome to On Point.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me to be on the show.
Of course. And let me start with you, Professor Ayer. Your thoughts on whether anything has really changed in Cuba with Raul Castro stepping down. Is this the new era that we've been hearing about?
Now, this is not a new era, at least not immediately. Until all the old men who fought with Fidel and Raul are gone, there can't be a new era, or at least until they're totally incapacitated. The only good thing about death, I always say, is that it also takes away the bad guys. And once they're dead, maybe there's
a
chance for change.
It's a fatalist view, isn't it?
Well, that's what happens when you grow up in a dictatorship. You can't keep waiting for the bad guys to pass away. But no, I think for the immediate future, it's very, very difficult to predict any real substantial change.
You're
at
not
least while Raul is still alive.
As an exerting power. Uh-huh.
Yeah, he's still in charge of the Communist Party, which runs everything, and he's also in charge of the military, which owns practically everything on the island.
Pedro Ferry, let me ask you to weigh in here. We're hearing from Professor Ayer that he expects nothing to change, that the power behind the throne is still Raul Castro and exerting a lot of control. How do you see things?
I'm going to nuance Professor Ayer's view. I agree with him that I don't see a prospect for this immediate drastic change. But I always remember that when Mikhail Gorbachev was interviewing for the head job in the USSR, he didn't say, look, I'm going to blow this thing up and we're going to start fresh. He came in as an apparatchik, exactly as Díaz-Canel did. It is true also that as long as the old historicos, the ones who fought in the hills, are still around, they're going to be exerting their influence, not to move the needle in any way, shape, or form away from that centrally planned, centrally controlled economy and government. However, having said that, I will tell you from my experience in Cuba that Cuba is absolutely not monolithic, and there are competing interests within the Cuban government and within Cuban society, including a small but still significant and growing slowly into more significance private sector. They're beginning to contribute more to the Cuban economy, and the Cuban government grudgingly and not with any great degree of sympathy has begun to acknowledge that they have a significant role to play, and I think that's an important development.
I'm curious, in your dealings, Pedro Ferry, in helping U.S. companies doing business, there has been some measure of economic reform in Cuba under Raul Castro. Has that helped your clients in any way? Are you seeing an opening, or have things sort of slipped back to the way they were?
I think things are backsliding, and I think that's a combination. Number one, the Cuban government, which is nominally a revolutionary government, is in reality an extremely conservative government. And they're plotting in their decision-making process. They're very, very careful. Control and power for them is critical. So they have not implemented the reforms with anywhere near the speed that they need to. As a result, the economy is stagnant. That private sector, the growth has slowed dramatically. And when you combine that with what I believe to be the profoundly misguided policies of the Trump administration, you have a situation where Cuba has really not taken off. I was there during the heady days of 2015 to 2017, and you could feel and sense in the street that sense of hope and ebullience and this entrepreneurial drive. And I think that has, at this moment, it's absolutely frozen. And that's an issue that Díaz-Canel needs to address.
Carlos Herrera, as I understand it, you have not been back to Cuba. You feel you would not be allowed to go back to Cuba. Is that correct?
I was notified by the U.S. State Department some years ago, back in 2003, that I was on the list of enemies of the revolution and I should not attempt to travel to Cuba. But even if I could travel, I wouldn't want to go.
Why not?
Well, for one thing, my being there gives some legitimacy to these criminals who run the place. And all the money I would spend there would go, almost all of it, directly into their pockets. So I can't go. Plus, I don't have any family left in Cuba. Castro regime destroyed my family completely. There's nobody left there.
Destroyed it. So, explain briefly what you mean by that. Destroyed it, meaning they all left, or they...
Meaning that some left and some were not allowed to leave and had to stay behind. But those few that did remain because they could not leave have passed away.
I see.
And the family scattered all over three different continents.
Wow. Stay with us, Carlos Herrera and Pedro Ferre. We are going to continue the conversation after the break. We're discussing a new era in Cuba, potentially, as six decades of Castro rule come to an end. Is it a new era in name only? You can join the conversation. Do you have family in Cuba? What are you hearing from them? What would you like to see happen with U.S.-Cuba relations? I'm Melissa Block, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Dell Technologies. Can technology reduce healthcare costs? What will it take to personalize the education of every student? And where does the media go from here? Find these answers and more on Trailblazers, a podcast hosted by best-selling author Walter Isaacson and joined by extraordinary guests who share their stories, insights, and the lessons they learned while transforming entire industries. Stream Trailblazers in your favorite podcast app or at delltechnologies.com/trailblazers.
Hi, I'm Mindy Thomas from NPR's Wow in the World. And this week, it's all about Operation Earth, how to be cool to a planet that's getting hot. Check it out with the curious and conscientious kids in your life. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Melissa Block. We're talking about Cuba after the Castros and the changing of the guard that happened there today. You can join the conversation. Did you celebrate the opening of travel to Cuba under President Obama? Do you hope a new Cuban president could warm up Cuba's now frosty relationship with the U.S., or do you think that that shouldn't happen? We are at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Cuban-Americans Pedro Ferre, a lawyer in Miami, and Carlos Herrera, who's a professor at Yale. But first, joining us now from Havana is CNN's Patrick Oppen. Patrick, welcome to On Point.
Hello there, Melissa. How are you doing?
Doing great, thanks. And tell us what you've been hearing from Cubans today about this change in leadership. How are they receiving the news? Do they see this signaling a fundamental change or not?
They don't see it as a fundamental change. You know, we're watching Raul Castro speak to the nation live right now. I think he's talked longer than any other speech in the 6 years that I've been living here. Huh. Unlike his brother, he didn't like to give speeches. He doesn't really give long speeches. And yet he's up there. He knows this is something of a goodbye. He's 86 years old, and he has said he did not want to do what his brother Fidel did and essentially wait until he was almost dying to make changes and who's going to succeed him to make those decisions. So Raul Castro has handpicked somebody from the next generation who he obviously feels is completely loyal, will follow the path that he and his brother set. And as well, he has stacked the cabinet, the Consejo de Estado, the Council of State, with a number of people who fought in the revolution with him, will probably keep a very close eye on what Miguel Díaz-Canel does. So it is a generational change, but up until a point. And as well, Raul Castro will stay for the next 3 years as head of the Communist Party. That's an incredibly important and powerful body here, and as head of the armed forces, which is probably the most powerful institution in the country. So he is giving up one title, the presidency of the country, but holding on to two titles that are arguably more powerful than the one he's giving up.
And Patrick, when you talk to Cubans about daily life, and especially about freedom of expression, human rights, general day-to-day liberties, do they? How would you describe their outlook at this moment in time?
The two things that everyone says to you is that salaries are too low, and the prices in the stores are too high. You know, 80% of the country, more or less, still works for the government, and none of those people make a living wage. Everyone has to do something on the side. They get billions of dollars from remittances from abroad, mostly from South Florida, and that allows them to survive, and people really don't have a lot of time to think about anything else. And the people who step out, who try to enact a change the Cuban government does not want to see, are put in their place.
So it sounds like pocketbook issues are much more front and center in people's minds than the bigger questions if you're just struggling to put food on the table.
Of course. And the majority of this island has only ever known, until today, a president named Castro. So it's really hard for them to imagine any other reality. And when I've talked to people about transition and what do you think is going to change, I've gotten a shrug. And when I was walking around yesterday, more people seem to have baseball games and soap operas on than the news. Now, I don't know right now. People in my office, I have an office staff of five wonderful Cubans, and they are starting to watch us and really kind of pay attention. And it's something unique that, one, this process has been as open as it has. I was not allowed in. Foreign journalists were not allowed in. But it was televised live. That's something new. And they're seeing behind the curtain a little bit. Of course, you know, it's more of a coronation than an election. There was only one candidate to vote for yesterday, and he got every vote but one. So this really wasn't a surprise. It really wasn't, in any sense, a contest. There wasn't any competition
right
here. But it's still something new to have a leader who is of a younger generation, who may think the same things, but does behave in a different way. When he went to vote in the National Assembly elections, also single-party, single-candidate elections, Miguel Díaz-Canel didn't come in with a huge squadron of bodyguards like Fidel Castro or Raul Castro would have done. He went and you know, he knew he was under the microscope. We'd been invited to film him, and got in line and talked to his neighbors in his hometown of Santa Clara and shook hands and kissed babies and took selfies. So he's trying to give a different image. The question is, even if he wants to do things differently, will he have the power to carry out those actions?
And you raise an interesting point, Patrick, and I'd love to hear from our other guests on this as well. The notion that there's a younger generation that does not remember the revolution, how that might impact, and especially with, and I know obviously internet access is far from widespread in Cuba, but with the advent of social media and a lot of outside information, whether expectations of young people will be different and whether that might lead to, by necessity, lead to social change. What do you think, Patrick?
One of the biggest changes in the 6 years I've been living here has been the growth of internet. It has exploded here, even though most people still don't have it in their phones, still don't have it in their houses. You can go to these Wi-Fi hotspots, something that didn't exist before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unless you had it in your government job, or you were somebody special, or you could pretend to be a foreigner and get in a hotel, you were completely offline until about 4 years ago, 3 years ago, and now they've just grown. And in my neighborhood, I'll see people out in the middle of the night in rainstorms checking their email, on Facebook, Skyping with family members they haven't seen in years, doing business, creating apps. And even though the internet is so limited, Cubans, who are the most inventive people, I think, in the world, constantly come up with new ways. The government gives them an inch and they take a mile. And so even just on the Malecón yesterday, the big seawall in front of Havana,
mm-hmm.
it seemed like there were more people looking at their phones and looking at the ocean. And that's something very new here that is having an impact.
As in Cuba, so it is around the world. Carlos Eyre, what do you think? I mean, does a younger generation signal some expectation that things will change in Cuba?
Oh, I think that's natural, that younger people make up their own minds. But one little twist in Cuba is that all of these young people have been taught a very one-sided history of what happened in Cuba. And many of them actually have no clue as to what the real history of Cuba was, because all of the education they have received is a form of indoctrination, which tells the Castro side of the story and omits all the other perspectives. So it'll be interesting to see 15 years from now, let's see, 10, mm-hmm. 15 years mm-hmm. from now. It'll be very, very interesting to see what these younger people actually do. And whether, in fact, all of this required affirmation of the great triumph of the Reformation brought on by Fidel through his revolution, whether that will change.
Yeah. Pedro Ferrer, you go back and forth from Florida to Cuba quite a bit. What do you hear, especially from young people, and are their expectations different? Do you think that could lead in a different direction for Cuba?
Yes. Yes, their expectations are different. And I was listening to Patrick, and that resonated, that folks are very much worried about wallet issues, mm-hmm. and younger folks in particular. And younger folks also are very much focused on the tech aspects, you know, this thing, the ability to access the internet and so forth. And I think the push and I think the challenge for Díaz-Canel is to make sure that he steps in line with the expectations of the younger folks. And one of the things that is very peculiar about Cuba, and this goes back to the inventiveness issue, is that notwithstanding the absolute government control over the media and so forth, Cubans find a way to find out what the heck's going on. And there's something called El Paquete, which is you basically have these flash drives with news programs and movies and information, and people trade that and sell it and circulate it and so forth. So it is absolutely astonishing to me, and I've seen this in Havana, and I've seen it in out-of-the-way places like Cienfuegos, which is a smaller city up the coast, that people are very, very aware of what the heck's going on. Now, all that you need to take with a grain of salt, because I will also agree with Professor Ayre that the information that they've gotten and the education they got was their particular view, the socialist Marxist view of history, which is a distortion, and it's not really a very balanced view. But notwithstanding that, and I think a lot having to do with the contacts and the travel by Cuban Americans, Cubans are better informed than you would believe, and I think that drives their expectations.
Mm-hmm. We were talking about U.S. policy toward Cuba and how that has shifted under President Trump. Let's go back in time just 2 years ago to 2016, when President Obama visited Havana. He was the first sitting president to go to Cuba in 88 years at the time. It was at the moment when they were normalizing relations. They were reopening the U.S. embassy, and things looked quite a bit different. They were signaling big changes in the U.S. relationship. He spoke directly to the Cuban people in a long speech in Havana.
In a world that remade itself time and again, one constant was the conflict between the United States and Cuba. I have come here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas. I have come here to extend the hand of friendship to the Cuban people.
So that was President Obama speaking in Havana in 2016. Fast forward a year to President Trump in Miami, speaking in June of last year, blasting the policy of the Obama administration to normalize relations with Cuba.
They made a deal with a government that spreads violence and instability in the region, and nothing they got. Think of it. Nothing they got. They fought for everything, and we just didn't fight hard enough. But now, those days are over. Now we hold the cards. We now hold the cards.
So that's President Trump speaking last summer. Patrick Oppmann in Havana, what does the new Trump administration's policy mean for Cubans or for Cuban Americans who are trying to go back and forth to Cuba? How have things shifted?
Well, for Cuban Americans, the changes under President Obama are still in place, and those are mainly the people you see off getting off these direct flights are Cuban Americans, and they're coming back, many of them in droves and carrying suitcases. They call it gusanos, worms with worms, these long duffels, because that's what Fidel called them when they left, huh. And now they're coming back with long duffels that are helping to rebuild this country one duffel bag at a time. President Trump said he tore up the Obama changes with Cuba, and he didn't really do that, but it did cause a lot of Americans to think twice about coming here. There are further restrictions on travel to Cuba. There are hotels you can't stay in. It gets a little complicated, and a lot of people just think it's too much trouble for a vacation. I'm looking out right now from my office at an American cruise ship. We're seeing a lot more of those. But for the average American tourist, you know, it's also not easy to come here. Your credit card doesn't work. Your cell phone may not work. So it requires a lot of perhaps adventurous spirit. And most people that I talk to say, I came, it was interesting. It was a little sad, all the buildings falling down, and I didn't think I'd come back.
Okay.
So what has changed, though, is for the Cuban people who are so excited when President Obama came here, felt that he really spoke to them, looked more like them than their own leaders. Now to have President Trump attacking them and their own government attacking him, they feel like they've gone back in time to an era that they really wish they'd left a long time beforehand.
Patrick Upman, thanks so much for joining us. Patrick Upman is CNN correspondent based in Havana. Thanks again.
Thank you.
And we're talking about the change of leadership in Cuba today with 57-year-old Miguel Diaz-Canel taking over from Raul Castro. Let's go to the phones to Yvonne in Miami, Florida. Yvonne, you're on the air.
Hi, Melissa.
Hey, thanks for calling.
You know, I hear a lot about change. My dad came in here in the 60s. He was born in 1929. I'm 30 now. He had me when he was old.
He came from Cuba.
You know, he came from Cuba, right. He got to the U.S. in the 60s, and he died in 2005. And he thought that there was going to be imminent change. He thought that for many decades. And it didn't happen. And those that went into exile have pretty much died, those that were adults when it happened. So the war's pretty much over, you know, in that sense. And, you know, if there is change, it's going to go like molasses. And it's sad because, like he mentioned, people that are now, you know, 60 were born when the revolution happened. They don't know a Cuba before that. And the Cuba that exists today is very different than the Cuba that existed in the 50s. Something that I'm curious about, and I'd like to know if any of your guests are familiar with this individual's history. Has he flown to other countries? Has he traveled the world? Or is he just an individual who lived in Cuba and, you know, is part of the bureaucracy?
You're talking about the new president, Miguel Diaz-Canel. It's a good question. Let's put it to our guest. Carlos Herrera, do you know what the new president's international spectrum has been?
I have seen photos of him overseas. He's been sent as an official because he was one of the five vice presidents. So he has traveled abroad and he has conducted government business with other nations. But the extent of that, I'm not sure. I haven't seen more than, let's say, a dozen photos or so of him posing with foreign leaders.
Uh-huh. And Pedro Freire, what about you? What do you know of the new president's international bent?
It's limited. He did travel to Europe. He was in France recently. And I do know that he had a stint, I believe, in Nicaragua doing one of those international missions that the Cuban government requests and requires for their party members and so on. But I would not say that he is a particularly well-traveled man.
Let's go back to the phones to Tampa and to caller Juan Carlos. Juan Carlos, you're on the air.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you for having me
of
today.
Course. You bet.
Yeah, very interesting topic that you have on the air today. I was born in Cuba in 1965, and I'm part of the generation of Cubans that used to get arrested on the streets of Havana City for listening to Jimi Hendrix or Black Sabbath or Carlos Santana.
Oh, well, you were a Jimi Hendrix and Carlos Santana fan, huh?
Yeah, well, back in that time, we used to get arrested for listening to Willie Chirino, to anybody. There was part of the free music, the music that spread freedom, is, you know, explain to people different things about another country.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my taking about this situation is that apparently Fidel Castro, after he died, he's still appointing people in the government. And that's what happened when countries and people who are leaders in any country don't pay attention to history closely, and allow people to get into power and to grab power and start appointing people that only respond to their interests, mm-hmm. just like Donald Trump is doing in this country. It's there's dictators in countries that they are capitalist to. You know, there is not only dictators in socialist countries.
So Juan Carlos, you're not seeing, you're saying that, that basically Fidel Castro is ruling from the grave?
Yeah, that's what happens when that happens with North Korea. That's happening, that happens in China. And it happens in every other country that practice communism. And it's about to happen here in the United States if the rule of law doesn't don't get imposed.
Okay, Juan Carlos, thank you. Thank you very much for your call. And I'd be curious to hear, Carlos Ayer, your take on that. The extent to which Fidel Castro still basically is the ruler of Cuba, even though he is deceased.
Yeah, well, his ashes can't do too much. But he is a sort of a quasi-divine figure. That's the way he's been portrayed by his own ministry of truth. Let's use an Orwellian term. Yeah, you see, he said he didn't want a cult of his personality after his death, but in fact, he is pretty much in everyone's mind, even though he's dead. But he's not running things, and Raul is for the moment still doing most of the governing in Cuba. It's going to slip from his hands just because of his age. And that's the real change factor, is his age.
Okay, keep that thought. Carlos Ayer, stay with us. Pedro Freire as well. We are discussing Raul Castro stepping down as Cuban president. I'm Melissa Block. This is On Point.
Are you funnier than Fallon? More amusing than Aziz? More clever than Click and Clack? Well, if you've got an idea that'll make people laugh, enter WBUR's Next Great Show contest for a chance to get your show on the air. To find out more, go to WBUR.org/nextgreatshow.
This is On Point. I'm Melissa Block. We're talking about Cuba's future and U.S.-Cuba relations. You can join the conversation. Are you hopeful that U.S.-Cuban relations will get back on track? Are you doing business with Cuba or trying to do business there? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with attorney Pedro Freire and Professor Carlos Ayer. They both left Cuba at the age of 11. And we're joined now also by Achi Obejas in Oakland, California. She is a Cuban-American writer and translator, and she immigrated with her family when she was six from Cuba to the United States during the Cuban Revolution. Achi Obejas, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And I'd be curious to hear a little bit more from all of you. And Achi, let's start with you about what we've been hearing from our guests that I believe one of them said change will come like molasses. Do you think that's true?
Oh, I think that's true. I think the major changes that we could have expected already came when Raul came into power. He did make some very important and serious changes. He made a series of changes in the economy that opened up markets. I mean, it's still very restricted, still very screwy, but he did sort of rely on some small, capitalistic ventures in a way that I think Fidel never would have. He also opened relations with the United States, which is no small feat. And lastly, his treatment of dissidents is absolutely different, much crueler in a way than the way Fidel was handling dissidents. I mean, part of it has to do with technology and the way that dissidents now operate, but there's just a general, more aggressive attitude towards dissidents under Raul than there ever was with Fidel. Fidel mostly ignored them, and then when they finally yanked his chain, he would toss him in jail for, 100 years. Raul is a much more calculated and deliberate person, and he basically haunts these people. He has mobs attack them. He, disappears them for a day or two. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a wearing down of the opposition.
So you're saying that as far as human rights go, things you say were worse under Raul Castro than under Fidel, and it'll be interesting to see if anything changes under the new president, under Miguel Diaz-Canel.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones, if we can, to Harrisonburg, Virginia, and to Roberto. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm here. Thank you, Melissa, for taking my call.
Of course.
Yeah, I'm a young Cuban. I came to the United States 5 years ago, and I'm from this new generation that pretty much we don't have any connection with the government of Cuba, with that they call the revolution. They haven't done pretty much anything for us, and we have expecting change from so long, and we keep receiving nothing from them. So pretty much the only options that we have, the ones that have an open mind or maybe a different mentality, it's just leave Cuba and try to make another life in another country, like I'm doing right here. I think this change of government, most of the Cubans, we don't expect anything from it, because we have been expecting changes that they never come, and they partially have taken the hope from the Cuban people, and that probably sounds pretty bad, but it's almost true. And I feel like the Cubans that we are now outside of Cuba, we need to get together and help to bring that hope back and make change for the Cuban government to make change.
Would you have any expectation, Roberto, that you one day might go back to live in Cuba, that things will have changed enough that you would want to go back home?
I will love that. I will really love to go back to Cuba and go to my homeland and see, make a change or help to that change that will have to come. I was listening that probably what will happen with the new generation from 10 or 15 years next. And I think that generation will have even less connections than what we have right now. And it will be a generation that doesn't have nothing, absolutely nothing in common with that they call revolution and all the principles they fought for or they keep trying to impose in these new generations. Mm-hmm. We don't even see why.
Yeah. Pedro Freire, when you go to Cuba, do you hear a lot of voices like we're hearing from Roberto there?
Very much so. And that's one of the things that at the one hand is very discouraging, because you hear that concept of there's nothing for me here. My government doesn't listen to me. There's no hope. There's no future. I want to be a foreigner. And it's a horrible brain drain for Cuba. And you can just see how that in the long term does not bode well for the future of Cuba. But I also find some hope in what the caller is saying. And I find some hope in the streets of Havana, because I will tell you one thing, the creativity and energy of the Cuban people, and particularly of that young generation, should not be underestimated. And I'm also struck by the fact that we have bought into this concept of nothing changes, nothing will ever change. And it's correct. I mean, the pace of change is glacial. But someone once said, things don't change, and then they change, and they change all of a sudden. And I am a firm believer, and I believe in the Cuban people, and this is why I supported the Obama administration so strongly. The message that President Obama delivered in that brilliant speech was, si se puede, yes, we can. And it isn't that the United States is going to change Cuba. The change has to come from Cuba, and it is that generation that will make the change.
And Roberto, when you listen to Mr. Freire there talking about hope and energy, does that ring true to you? Do you hear from your friends that maybe they still have that hope that things will change?
Yes, I really believe that there is a young generation in Cuba that we have hope still, the ones that are still there. And but like I said, I feel like we should do more, because we are talking about a real dictatorial government that has been in the power for over 50 years, and this is something that it doesn't go off just like that, I believe. And we all have to work hard for it. We are looking at what is going on in Venezuela right now, and all this kind of mentality, mm-hmm, and government spreading through the whole Latin America. And I really believe we should get together and fight harder this kind of government that oppress our people.
Thank you for your call. Achi Obejas, when you think about the future of Cuba and think about the U.S. policy toward Cuba, were you supportive of the Obama administration's opening up, or would you say you're more in line with President Trump saying that's the wrong message to send to this regime?
Oh, no, God, I was absolutely in favor of the Obama policy change, in part because I just thought nothing else was working, and it was just time to try anything, really, to try to move the dial a little bit. I do want to say that this brain drain is actually one of the most serious problems facing Cuba, because what's happening is that the people that are staying behind and becoming involved in government are not the best and the brightest. The best and the brightest are either leaving the country for the United States or Europe or other Latin American countries because they don't just come here. This is a generation that has a very broad diaspora. But also the folks who are, you know, really, really best and bright who stay behind tend to sort of take an apolitical stance and do things outside of official circles. And, you know, government actually has a very difficult time recruiting people. A great example of that is the Ministry of Culture, where you would think that some of the most creative people would be, you know, anxious to, you know, have some say and have you know, participation and be able to get things done. In fact, they've just recently renamed Abel Prieto as Minister of Culture, in great part because they didn't have anybody else in line who could do it. Hmm. And the last three guys were disasters.
Let's go back to the phones to Pensacola, Florida, and our caller, Dan. Dan, you're on the air.
Yeah, I think it's important to go back in history that when you have sanctions by a country as powerful as the United States, we're talking about a form of destruction to your country, where they're investing millions and millions of dollars to destroy your economy and stuff with the CIA and stuff like that. It's important to know that. That's a tremendous cost to Cuba. So, you know, how much change do people want when your past is, you got almost like a 50-year war against you. And sanctions are a form of warfare. Like, you can destroy a country with sanctions, easy.
Dan, thank you so much for your call. Carlos Ayer, what about that, the effect of sanctions and whether they had their intended effect, which would be to bring change to Cuba?
The so-called embargo, which they love to call the blockade in Cuba, is full of holes, and Pedro Freire could tell you because he deals with American businessmen trying to establish business in Cuba. Cuba can buy whatever it wants from the rest of the world, but it has to buy from the United States in cash, no credit. It has owed billions, and billions have been forgiven other countries, including Russia, because it never pays its bills. The embargo right now is still full of holes. It's not the cause of the collapse of the Cuban economy. The collapse of the Cuban economy has been the Castro regime, as can be seen very, very clearly in Venezuela, where there has been no embargo and their economy has collapsed. As for sanctions, well, I'm a great believer in sanctions because it was sanctions that toppled the apartheid regime in South Africa. And I know that the people have difference of opinion about the impact of sanctions, but sanctions sometimes do work positively. And I know that some people consider me an extremist on this, but I think it would be wonderful if the entire free world, people who go to Cuba as tourists, would take the same attitude towards Castro Cuba that they did towards South Africa, where if one went to South Africa, one became an instant pariah.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom line, bottom line is the Cuban economy has not collapsed because of the embargo. It's because of the Castro economic policies.
And Pedro Freire, that is the big question, right? The big dilemma over sanctions is, does isolation further change, or does it just entrench a system that's already in place? From a business perspective, what have you seen as the effect?
I'm going to tell you what I've seen, and once again, I agree with Professor Ayre that the reason the Cuban economy doesn't work is principally because it's a centrally planned Marxist command economy, and we know that historically.
And because
that's
the Soviet Union, and because the Soviet Union collapsed, and they had
That's exactly right. So the subsidies went away, and then it just doesn't work. But I think where the error, the American error, has been is here is David and Goliath. Here is the narrative of the big neighbor to the north. Putting all kinds of roadblocks, blocking financial transactions. And I think you see it in the vote of the UN. The vote every year is 159-1, 159-2. I think we lost the Marshall Islands last year. It's because the consensus is, and again, this is a narrative that the Cuban government has used brilliantly. It's David and Goliath, you're beating me up, and it's an excuse for everything. And the truth of the matter is that the Cuban government, and this is a challenge for Díaz-Canel, needs to stop deceiving itself. The the reason the Cuban economy is dysfunctional is because it is a centrally planned economy, and you are holding down the creativity and the entrepreneurial spirit of the Cuban people, and you're not allowing Cuban Americans to invest there in significant ways to help develop the country. They have to do it with the gusanos, and you cannot rebuild the country that way. So, and in terms of the policies that we have been putting forth, I will tell you this. I will tell you that the programs under the Obama administration that allowed U.S. businesses to do things like bed and breakfast, that has put a significant amount of money directly into the hands of the Cuban people. And that has made a big change in Cuba.
And I believe that the Cuban government is sort of clamping down on that. Now let's go to the phones. Mary in Tampa, Florida has a point along these lines, I believe. Mary, go ahead.
How you doing?
Great.
I have been a working journalist out of Tampa, and I've been to Cuba about five or six different times as a working journalist, once as a tourist. And I was there in 91 when there was no lights, no gas. It was just abject poverty. It was the worst I had seen, you know, garbage in the streets, starving dogs roaming. I went back in 2015. There's Airbnb. There's Paladars. There were restaurants. I was there in 98 for the Pope's visit. So they built a five-star hotel to house American media. Europe's there. Germany's there. Spain is there. Countries from all over the world are there. What little I have seen in such a quick manner that fronted that change has been European money. I think they're going to do it without us. And then, of course, you know, expats, Cubans are sending billions and billions and billions of dollars to the island. These people are intelligent. They're smart. They're hopeful. They're scrapping. They're making it the best they can. I think the only loser here is America. We're not there. We're not making any money. And we're not doing anything for our own country.
So Mary is saying the United States is missing out on opportunities in Cuba. Achi Obejas, what do you think about what Mary had to say?
Oh, I agree with her. I don't support sanctions at all, actually. I think that if we were dealing with Cuba as if it were a normal country, if we were dealing with Cuba as an equal, that things would be quite different. Because I think, you know, the problem with sanctions is that ultimately who they hurt is the people. The government is not hurt. The people in government continue to live quite lavishly. But the average common person who can't access particular medicines, who can't access a part for an appliance that they might have, that is an American appliance that they've kept around since 1956, you know, that kind of thing is very problematic. And, you know, this is an embargo that does not work. It's wishful thinking. I mean, the idea that, well, if everybody went along with it, yeah, but nobody does. Nobody goes along with the embargo. So the only people who get hurt are Cubans. You know, the notion that Cuba can buy anything from anybody else is a little perverse, because we are Cuba's closest neighbor. Anything American, and Cuba's infrastructure is American and Soviet.
Achi Obejas, I'm sorry to cut you off there. I wish we could continue the conversation. There's so much more to talk about, but we are headed towards the end of our show. Achi Obejas, writer and translator, Cuban-born, thank you so much. Also, we heard from Carlos Ayer, professor at Yale University. Professor Ayer, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me on the show. Thank you very much.
You bet. And Pedro Freire, attorney with the Akerman Law Firm, thanks to you. It was great to hear from you.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Melissa Block. You've been listening to On Point.